Philadelphia, Philadelphia, are you ready? City of brotherly love, home of smoking Joe Frazier. Come on. It's about that time. FetLifeStation.com. Philly Fridays, baby. Come on.
Christina Rands with Jail Talk. Before I get started, I think it's important that we let the audience listening out there understand the reasoning behind Jail Talk. I have been saying for some time now we needed a platform and outlet to have conversations related to what's taking place with the prison system, the effects that it has on all parties impacted by the system, such as those who are survivors of violence, individuals incarcerated, families, and communities. My goal is bringing more awareness to the side effects of prison and helping those who aren't aware to become educated, because this can happen to anyone. In today's show, we have Carrie Shakabuna Marshall. He is a human rights activist co-heading the Human Rights Coalition and Coalition to Abolish Death by Incarceration. In addition, he is a council member of Decarcerated PA. He's also a founder and editor of the Movement magazine and published correspondence for various media outlets like Prison Radio, Socialist Viewpoint, San Francisco Bayview, and Workers World. And today's discussion, we'll be having a conversation. And Shakabuna grew up in West Philly. Oh, there you go. I hear you. You ready to go? He grew up in West Philly, was a juvenile that received a life sentence and was released during the youth resentencing bill that passed with Miller versus Alabama, which deemed it unconstitutional to keep youth incarcerated under the age of 18. Shakabuna served 34 years and was released in May 11th of 2023. So it's been a year officially, Shakabuna.
Yeah.
Welcome back.
Thank you. Thank you. I appreciate you, Christina. Thank you for having me on your show. Yeah, it's been a year, you know, and I just celebrated a year anniversary out here with my family. And we just had a good family outing with each other, you know.
What did you do for that year? Like, how did you celebrate? I know that I feel like being home a year is still fairly new. So it's like to be home and know that last year you were in a whole different place, a whole different headspace. Like, how did it feel celebrating?
Yeah, well, like, even though I did a lot of work throughout this whole year, but I definitely did a little self-care, you know what I'm saying? So that self-care looked at, like, me, you know, going to different restaurants, eating, because, you know, in prison we get the worst of foods. You don't have proper nutrients and things. And so I wanted to go out and I wanted to enjoy good food, nice food. So I attended restaurants and I attended a few parties, you know, but social gatherings, not the real wild ones, but just social gatherings with friends and families over the year.
So can I ask you, what was that meal like when you first got home and, you know, you were able to, like, sit down, have silverware, you know, eat something that you actually wanted to eat, and something that was made with love?
Man, that was like, you know, it's like I was in heaven. You know what I'm saying? It's like I was in heaven when I, you know how you seen the movie and they eat that barbecue chicken or them barbecue ribs and he say it's so good, make you want to slap your mama. That food was so good, made me want to slap my mama.
I'm laughing because I literally had some barbecue food today. So Shaka Buna, so you celebrated last week, right?
Yeah.
And you know, can you tell the audience, like, how old were you initially? I know we talked about you being incarcerated for 34 years, and that is a very long time. But how old were you?
Well, I was 17 years old when I first entered prison. So that means I was certified as a juvenile to be tried by a jury and sent to adult prison. And so, you know, I came to jail. I was 17. I was probably a couple months shy of my 18th birthday.
Oh, wow. So can you tell me a little bit about, like, how did you get into that situation of getting incarcerated? Like, what led up to that moment?
Well, I think it was several things. You know, growing up, sometimes you feel you don't feel the love that you want to feel from your families or whatnot. So I came across that from a lot of individuals that were in prison over the years. You know, they lack love from their families. And so I think it was part of that. I think it was also part of the racism that I experienced while growing up as a young black boy in the city of Philadelphia, which I believe is one of the racist cities in the country on the low, you know what I mean? But they try not to make it appear that way. And I think it had to do also with me, you know, just being youthful and experimenting with different drugs, like, you know, pills and marijuana. And so I think that type of drugs actually clouds your judgment. And then I think just me being young and having and not having a fully developed brain where you have the you have the forethought, you know, you're able to think things through like an adult would, and immaturity, you haven't matured yet, you know, and so you're still thinking like a child, you're still acting like a child, even if in your own mind you think you're a grown man. And I think all of those things contributed to me, you know, making a bad choice, one bad decision in my life that cost me my life by going to prison with a life sentence, but also, you know, the deceased life, you know, that I wanted. Mm-hmm.
I think for myself, just listening to what you're expressing, like growing up in the 80s was very hard. Especially if you lived in a certain community where it was just plagued with poverty, violence, drugs, dysfunctional households, and you're just being a witness to all of those things. And not necessarily do you want to grow up, but it's like you have to grow up because of what you're being exposed to.
Yeah, I think that's very much true. And I think when you look at it, you know, that was a time during the height of the so-called war on drugs that the government was imposing upon our communities. And all of what you said, when you consider all of what you said, I was one of those many millions of young black boys and young black males, right?
Mm-hmm.
That felt things was hopeless. You see? And so when you have lost hope, you give up on life itself. And that's what we're dealing with right now with a lot of these young kids running around in every city around America that's doing a lot of committing a lot of violence, and a lot of gun violence and death. A lot of these kids don't have any hope anymore. and they just throwing their lives away. They don't care about their own lives, and they definitely don't care about other people's lives around them.
Do you have that perspective because now you're an adult opposed to like being a youth? Because for me, I feel like there's certain things that are kind of like those effects of these cycles that continue to happen, where I'm thinking about myself and I'm thinking about you as a youth. But I also feel like, you know, the same things are kind of still happening in the same communities.
Yeah, well,
even in this era.
Yeah, I mean, as an adult, you know, as I was growing into adulthood while in prison, I began to have that maturity about myself. I began to experience things and to become wise from those lessons that I was learning in life. And I got to be able to look in hindsight and see, you know, the effects of all things, of poverty, crime, and even my own actions within this whole thing. And so when I look back at it, that's what allows me to be able to see, because now, you know, I started looking at it from an adult perspective with a fully developed brain, right? And I'm looking back and I seen how, you know, I drove my mother crazy with many of the decisions that I was making. And I would think now, like, the hell was I thinking of doing X, Y, and Z as I was growing up and up as a young teenager? And so and in my mindset and my mature mentality today, I would never do some of the things that I've done when I was a child.
Most so, definitely. Yeah. So what was your initial like reaction? Like, what was it like for you at that age being sentenced? And then also, like, how did that have an effect on your family? Because I do know your family, and I know your mother is a major advocate for you, you know, just when you were away. But I know your mom, you know, your mom is amazing.
Yeah, so how I felt at the time is, and I still feel the same way, is that I was angry. And the reason I was angry is because, you know, a lot of us, we grow up on all the propaganda that America teaches, you know what I mean, about the law and so forth. So you always heard, oh, you have you're given a fair trial and stuff. You're innocent until proven guilty and all this other stuff, right? But in my experience, we are guilty, right, until proven innocent. So it's like it's the total opposite of what they say. And so I had to go through a system that already looked at me as guilty without any evidence, looked at me as guilty because I was a young black person sitting in the courtroom. And then I was also I felt as though I didn't have a fair trial. And that made me angry, you know, because I had an all white jury. I had one of the most racist judges in the country by the name of Lynn Abraham at the time. She was a judge, and this was before she came a DA. And so there was a lot of unfairness going on within my case because they racially charged my case, you know. And so I just didn't see me getting a fair trial. And I knew I was going to get sentenced to the death penalty or other death penalty, which we call life without parole. And so I understood at that moment that I had several strikes against me as a young black boy and a young black male coming into a United States courtroom. And that was one, I was black. Two, I was ignorant of the law. Three, I didn't have any power or influence or wealth. And so with those strikes right there, and four, I was poor. Five, I was poor. So that right there, I knew that I had multiple strikes against me, and I knew that I was going to be found guilty and that they were going to throw me under the jail, and that's what they did.
You know, I had a conversation the other day with someone, and we were talking about the judges, and I guess because it was around voting time. And I was saying to myself that we have the system that's put in place where we have to pick jurors and we have to have a judge and get lawyers and all types of things just to get all of this stuff set up. But then we have people that are judging cases that are not from those same communities. So they don't really understand the things that take place because they're coming from all over. Do you think that plays a role in how people are also sentenced at times?
Yeah, it definitely plays a role. One, because a lot of these people, let's face it, they are Caucasian male and female judges who are not from our communities, are disconnected from our communities. They receive the information about our people from racist newspaper organizations like the Philadelphia Daily News, and they believe in all the racial stereotypes that they have been taught all their lives as white people. And so when they sit up in these judge seat with that gavel in hand with their black robes, right? They are bringing all their racial prejudices and biases with to that chair and in judgment over you. So, you know, when I went to court and I was in trial, my judge, Lynn Abraham, you know, she was looking at my mother like my mother was, you know, of the lowest class. And she would make racial stereotypical statements like, you know, like assuming that I have no father, assuming that we are in poverty, and assuming all those racial stereotypes, like she's not a good mother, she's out there just letting her children run wild, when it was quite the opposite. My mother lived in an affluent neighborhood. She was highly educated. She worked in a white collar industry for the University of Pennsylvania. She lived in Cherry Hill, New Jersey, an affluent community. I went to the best schools. You know, and so I had a strict family. I had a father, you know what I'm saying? And so, you know, but still, that did not stop this judge from projecting her racial stereotypes against us. And that colored her judgment and how she treated us in that courtroom.
Wow. So what was the experience like being not only young, but being a black man going into the prison?
Oh man, it was a hell of an experience, because you know the prisons back then were very violent, and I remember my first day in, I won't say my first day, but about my second day in prison, you know, I was almost murdered by a couple prisoners, you know, and I wound up having to fight my way out of that situation, you know, but these guys, you know, had me trapped up with knives and pipes and stuff, and you know, and ready to assault me because we had prior beef, but they was looking to take my life, but it wasn't in the cards for that to happen, and I wasn't going to let that happen. So, that's how it is. That's how dangerous it is. You can walk into a situation, and immediately upon coming into a prison, you might have had an adversary or whatever from in the streets or from in prison before, and if they get the drop on you and get you first and ambush you, you might get knifed to death. You might get murdered. And so when I first came to prison, you know, I was in the same situation where I almost got murdered, you know, my second day there.
Wow. So I hear different stories. I hear stories that people have said when they've gone to a prison, they feel like they see a lot of people that are there from their communities. Some people are just having a really hard time, and they say like they have broken down because, you know, they realize the consequences of a mistake or an incident. I've had other people talk about how they went in and they just started rebelling because, you know, I guess they felt that the time that they were given was so long that for them it's like, all right, well, I don't have anything to keep fighting for. So what gave you hope while you were in prison that you knew you were coming home?
Well, what gave me hope was the fact that I just would not accept that this was my lot. You feel what I'm saying? I would not accept that this is where I was going to be the rest of my life. So I had made it up in my mind that I would do everything in my power to get out of prison and that I was going to make it out of prison. So I had faith, you know, not necessarily in a higher power, though I do believe in a higher power, but I had deep faith within myself and with the help of a higher power, I was going to make it out of prison one way or the other. I was going to come out of prison a free man, whether I come out through the courts legally, whether I came out by escaping, or whether I came out in a body bag trying to escape or fight for my freedom, I was coming out a free man.
Can we talk a little bit about how prison also made you an advocate for a lot of the changes and the conditions that were, you know, taking place in the prison, also about the way that people were being treated? I know that you have HRC, and for those of you who don't know what HRC is the Humans Right Coalition, and the main focus is to help those that are incarcerated, because at times they're trying to receive help from anybody, honestly, because some people may not have family, but you know, they're being mistreated. And although we have this prison system, for me, it's not designed to mistreat people that have already been mistreated.
Yeah, so Christina, let me say this first and foremost. I never considered myself an advocate. I considered myself a revolutionary and a freedom fighter, and I still do. So when I came to prison, you know, you have to realize that I came in very young, and the older guys that were there, they were guys that were there from the 1960s and the 1970s. A lot of them were gang members, and quite a few of them, a minority of them, were political prisoners. And even though we had a lot of gang members in the prisons at the time, even the prisons, the gang members, were politically conscious, right? And so I came into the prison system where the revolutionary movement, or the Black Power movement, that existed in the 1960s and the 70s, it existed in the prisons themselves. And so, so I'm coming off the street, and I was involved in positive things on the street growing up. And so when I came into prison, it wasn't nothing new to me. I came into prison doing some of the many things that I was doing on the street, you know? And so I just wasn't going for the BS. I wasn't going for the racism that these guards and these prison administrations was trying to put down on a lot of us incarcerated people. The control, the power and control that they were trying to do, the brutal oppression that they were doing. They were killing guys in prison. They was breaking limbs, knocking their teeth out, handicapping them, beating them until they was senseless and don't even have mental faculties anymore. And I wasn't going for it, you know? And many, many guys in my era was not going for it. So, you know, I came from an era of public enemy, fight the power and all that other stuff, man. And, you know, we went in there with that same attitude, and we wasn't taking no crap from nobody. And so, you know, we did what we did. We fought for it. We fought for our rights, you know, to be human beings, you know, and that means we wanted to be treated like human beings. And we wanted to live in a condition that was humane and not living, you know, where in conditions where you live in the cells or prison that's full of asbestos and black mold, right? Or being fed food and the food got maggots in it, or it got rat turds in it, or you find roaches in your food. You know, we didn't want to live in those conditions, and so we fought back.
Can you tell me, like, how many people have you been able to help, or even facilities? Because I know that when people are writing in about these conditions or how they're being mistreated, or just it could be like medical things that were not being addressed. Like, how many people have you been able to help through this coalition that you have with Human Rights Coalition?
I can't even put a number. You know, it's so many.
Is it only in Pennsylvania?
Yeah, well, initially we started in Philadelphia, started our first chapter in Philadelphia. We branched out and we started another chapter, a human rights chapter called in Pittsburgh called HRC Fed Up. And then we had another chapter in Chester, PA called HRC Chester. Eventually we wound up spreading all the way out to Texas. So in Houston, we had a HRC chapter called called HRC Houston. That was started by a brother by the name of Hassan Shakur, who was on Texas death row, and he was executed by the state. We had an international branch of the HRC. I think it was in Germany, and that was established by a brother by the name of Jerome Hoagie Coffey from North Philly, who was currently still incarcerated and whose innocence has been pretty much proven, and we're working to get him out right now. But him and his supporters has set up an international HRC chapter, a branch or support committee. So, and we was known around the world, people was hearing about us around the world and what we were doing in Pennsylvania and elsewhere. So we was spreading around, you know, to a lot of people in a lot of places.
Well, I really, really appreciate all the work that you're doing. I know your mom is a part of this and everyone else that's a part of the Human Rights Coalition, because it is something that is needed. It's something that is necessary. No one, regardless if you're in prison, should be treated poorly or, you know, have to be put through all of these conditions that you're talking about. I know that you also have your Movement magazine, and I wanted you to talk a little bit about that. You know, I know that you have a lot of different articles on different topics. Other people have been added to, like, you know, being people that are also writing on this magazine, whether it's about their life experiences, the new things that are taking place, things that people want to see change. How can people learn more about the magazine and also add to it? And if you can just kind of let me know, how often is this magazine circulated amongst the facilities in Pennsylvania? And is this magazine also, is it outside of the states? Like, are you sending this magazine, the Movement, to other institutions?
All right, so let me try to capture all that. What made me create the Movement magazine, this is the historical background of it, right? So in the 1990s, I was confined at the state penitentiary called Huntington State Penitentiary, which is in central Pennsylvania near Penn State University. And so while I was there, I used to have a lot of guys that, you know, we used to be talking, we'd be talking about the prison issues and stuff. So I was very good at explaining what the prison issues are and what we were going through as incarcerated people within these prisons. And so I learned this because when my family used to ask me how was I doing and everything, I would only respond, oh man, they doing this, they mistreating us, man, they racist, they mistreating us, they racist. But that's not really explaining what's going on with you. And so my family and friends never really understood, like, what is really going on with me. And so one day I just went into detail, and they were blown away by what I told them of what goes on in prison. And so I told them, I said, well, I've been telling you this. And they was like, no, you haven't. And then I realized that I actually haven't. I actually kept just giving them a general statement. Oh, they racist. They treat us bad. But I wasn't being descriptive. I wasn't going into detail of how this was occurring. So once I learned this, I learned how to start, you know, going to detail to people, explaining them about the criminal injustice system, as we called it. And so I had friends of mine that was like, yo, won't you talk to my mother talk to my, you know, my sister and tell and explain to them what you was explaining to me about the criminal justice system. And I would tell them, no, bro, you got to learn that on your own, because I don't feel comfortable talking to your beautiful mother and your beautiful sister. I don't want there to be no problems. You know what I'm saying? So, mm-hmm. you know, this is how I learned how to start talking about criminal justice. So I start thinking, well, one, what I need to do is create a newsletter or a magazine and start putting this information in there and giving it to the public. Now, at the time, many incarcerated people had magazines and newsletters and stuff like that. The only difference was their magazines and newsletters were focused to prisoners, right? And to me, that was like preaching to the choir. I don't need a magazine and a newsletter to tell me what I am experiencing, what I'm going through, right? So I thought that instead of these magazines sending that information to us and then educating us on the issues, that it should be turned around and focused into the society at large, to the public. And so that's what I did. So eventually, when we started the Human Rights Coalition, years later, we started an HRC newsletter. It was started by political prisoner Russell Maroon Schultz of the Black Panther Party for Self-Defense. And it was also, and then it was ran by a sister by the name of Walida Emarishi, right? And so me and her worked together on the HRC newsletter for about 3 to 4 years. She went and moved back to California, and then we was left with nothing. So I said, hey, well, this is my time to do the magazine that I had in my mind for 10 years prior. And so that came to be the Movement Magazine. I came up with the name The Movement because I was an admirer of the SNNC, SNNC, Student Nonviolent National Coordinating Committee, right?
Okay.
And their only publication that they ever had was a publication called The Movement. And I said, this is a good way to honor those people. So what I did was I named mine The Movement as a continuation of what SNCC was doing in the 1960s and the 1970s. So we created The Movement Magazine, and we made it free to everybody. I sent it out to the public and everything. And so the public gets to see, learn about criminal injustice issues. And we produced this magazine. We was producing it once a month, but then we start producing it quarterly. So the magazine is produced 4 times a year, right? And then we send the magazine all across America and overseas to people who want it. So if anyone who wants to read the Movement Magazine, they can contact the Movement, and we'll put them on the mailing list to receive a free issue or a free subscription of the magazine, and they will get it. We have people in California and Texas and New Jersey, New York, Chicago, and the federal system and state prison system. All these people, they be reading the Movement Magazine. So we're very popular right now.
Well, I did have a question about the accountability, because you said the reason why you started this was because there were a lot of issues taking place inside these institutions that were affecting people that were incarcerated. Like, who takes accountability for those type of incidents when they're taking place? Like, is there any type of accountability for the people that are doing those things? Because you can't possibly get served food and it have things in it, or get mistreated and like no one is doing anything to those people.
There's no accountability set up in the Pennsylvania Department of Corrections to hold people, staff members and employees who are doing wrong or who are committing illegal acts, right, to be held accountable. There's no mechanism. Their only person they report to is the commissioner of prisons themselves, or who they call the secretary. I think they call him the secretary of the Department of Corrections. The only person that's above him, which is his boss, is the Pennsylvania government. So there's no accountability. So one of the things that the Human Rights Coalition has been pushing out here for the last couple of years now is to establish a prison oversight committee or an independent prison oversight committee, or what they call an ombuds agency, which would hold DOC officials accountable for their actions. So if we have, let's say, a kitchen staff person that's constantly putting out bad food, rotten food, food with maggots in it, or contaminated food, or outdated and expired food, and they get busted, then they should be able to get reported to this prison oversight committee, and the prison oversight committee will do an investigation and handle it accordingly. If they're not in the wrong, then you know nothing will happen to them. But if they are in the wrong, then they got to get fired. But right now, it's nearly impossible for a correctional officer to get fired from their job, except for when they do two things, in my experience. One, they bring in drugs or other contraband into the prison, or two, they have sex with a prisoner. Them the only two times that, or only two things that have correctional officers get fired. Other than that, they have job security for life.
Wow, that's terrible. I did hear something about the provider that you were talking about. Is it an ombudsman person?
Yeah.
I'm not sure if I'm saying the term correctly, but I know ombudsman. They have a person that's actually doing that in New Jersey, and they said that, you know, they found that it was beneficial because a lot of these grievances that were being put into central office, whether it was coming from family members or individuals that were incarcerated, were just kind of being dismissed. And there were a lot of people that were also being placed into isolation for punitive reasons. And, you know, just the racism that you talk about, and just inappropriate behaviors that were taking place with the staff in these institutions. But I also feel like if we do have a person, it has to be a person that is not going to be looking at things from a biased standpoint and would be like a third party, so that they could really be straightforward about what's going on and even the conditions when you go into some of these facilities.
Right. It has to be whoever this agency, whenever it gets established, because we're going to get it established, it has to be an independent agency. It can't be underneath the Pennsylvania Department of Corrections. It can't be ran by them. It has to be independent. Because let me tell you something. Just last 2 months, SCI Rockview, which is the state correctional institution, Rockview, which is in state in middle PA, they done had 8 suicides. 8 suicides occurred within the last 2 months of guys in solitary confinement. The average amount of suicides that occur in a year throughout 25 state correctional institutions is usually around about anywhere between 5 and 7. But at this institution, you done had 8 in 2 months. And not a word has been said. The public doesn't even know.
That's terrible.
If we had an ombuds agency or independent prison oversight committee, like, they could investigate that. They can find out why this has occurred, and they can hold accountable any correctional employee, right, that's responsible for this. Because how is 8 suicides happening at one institution in 2 months? When you don't even have that number of suicides happening throughout 25 institutions within a year.
That's terrible.
Held them accountable. And another thing is this. In the federal prison system, I don't know, you mentioned New Jersey, but recently, the Federal Bureau of Prisons, legislature, the United States legislature, just announced that they were going to pass a law to create an ombuds agency, an independent one, to oversee the Federal Bureau of Prisons. And the reason why, because there's so much corruption that's going on in the federal prison system, is crazy. But you have so many murders that goes on in the federal. It's probably over 30 or more murders that happen in the federal prison system every year. Murders, and they never tell anything about it. They just sweep it under the rug. They have all types of correctional officers stealing money and bringing in contraband, all sorts of stuff, right? And so the federal government itself said they need an ombudsperson, but our state in Pennsylvania is not even making that type of move. It's forcing us, organizations like the Human Rights Coalition, to make that move on behalf of incarcerated people.
You know, you talking about the contraband, it just kind of made me think back to during the pandemic when there were no real statistics that reflected like how much drugs were going into the prison during that time when there weren't any visitors for almost a year and a half.
Yeah, I mean, listen, all the correctional officers, everybody knows it's not even a secret, but everybody knows that. If we're going to talk about contraband being bought, let's be specific, drugs being bought into these prisons, the fentanyl, the heroin, the cocaine, the deuce, which is really popular right now, and pills, right, and strips. All these types of drugs are majority bought in through correctional officers. I would say about maybe 90 to 95% of all the contraband that comes into prison comes in through guards. It doesn't come in through the visiting room like that or some other way or through the mail and all that. The vast majority, I would say about 90 to 95% of it come in through the guards. And everybody know this, right? And so a very small percentage of it will come through the visiting rooms. And hardly none of it come through the mail. However, during COVID and even before COVID, they had passed they came out and they had something about there was a big K2 scare, right? What they call deuce, that drug, a synthetic marijuana. And they said, oh, it contaminated a lot of people. A lot of guards was falling out, falling ill. But it was all a big conspiracy. Bring in a company by the name of Smart Communications to handle all the mail of the entire Department of Corrections, and if they would take all the mail that people's families would send in to them, all this mail would be photocopied and put into a security database that they can always have access to and retrieve, and they would create portfolios on you, dossiers on people, and this information will also be sold to security companies all around the country. They also are in partnership with the United States government, Department of Homeland Security. And this type of information of incarcerated people and their families are put in dossiers on security index lists within the Homeland Security. And so it's a huge money-making scheme, basically. And so, but they say they're doing it to stop drugs, but drugs never really coming in through the mail system any old way. They also use that scare tactic of drugs coming in and people falling out, guards falling out, to try to get a hold on incarcerated people's appeal process and working through the courts. That they wanted to be able to see what you were working on and then work with DAs all throughout the state. Give them information about what your trial strategy is, what your post-trial strategies is. You know, the same thing what they did with Bumi Abdul-Jabbar, another political prisoner in the state of Pennsylvania who once was on death row but is now serving a life without parole sentence, the other death penalty. But this is what they're doing. So it's all about money for these people, and they don't care about nothing else.
Well, what I admire about you, Shaka Buna, is number one, you came out here and you just came out running. Like, you were doing some amazing things in the community. Plus, you're still, you know, fighting for your brothers and sisters that are still incarcerated. Can we talk a little bit about the work you've been doing? Because I know that at the last event, you put together, you had some, you know, legislators that were present. And then you also, you know, had people that had came home and that are doing some very, very successful things in the community with themselves. And, you know, I really admire the fact that you wanted to showcase that. And I also admire the fact that you're working to showcase, you know, the great things that people are also doing on the inside.
Yeah. Yeah. Most definitely. So since I've been home, my job has been as the executive director of the Human Rights Coalition. So I have to take this organization and sort of like put it on my back and try to expand it so we can be of more help to incarcerated people, as well as our families, as well as our community. So with that, I had to work and start getting more funding for the organization. You know, I also had to start expanding the organization as far as committees. We just started a prison abolitionist archive center, where now we're archiving the writings of prisoners, organizations, you know, different movements going on throughout the whole entire criminal justice system within Pennsylvania. Just the other day, we received a small grant, you know, to further this action. I just also started the Movement Media Group, right? And the Movement Media Group, we're doing podcasts now. We have a podcast, me and a brother named Serge, Uptown Serge, Sergio Highland. He's known by all these names. They are one and the same person, you know, and he's out here doing amazing things. But we have this podcast called the Hydra Podcast. We're going to create more podcasts. We have a studio that we got. We got all the podcast equipment, cameras, everything. And so anybody that's trying to get on, we're trying to put them on and put them into work, and so we can start exposing what's going on, using media to expose what's going on in the criminal justice system in these prisons and what's going on out here in these communities too, in terms of violence and crime and so forth. I also started what I call the ICPI, which stands for Incarcerated Citizens Voting Initiative. And there I work with a coalition of other groups in the city, such as the ACLU, Pennsylvania Penn Franchise Project. I work with the Committee of 70, Prison Society. We all work together to start trying to bring about voting for incarcerated people on the county level at Philadelphia's four county prisons, which holds approximately 7,000 people. And we're trying to get the franchise of voting back to the 50,000 state prisoners. This is a hard, long fight, but we're working with these organizations. We're working with other organizations across the state and coalitions in Allegheny County, Pittsburgh, and we're working with national organizations to help us try to get the 50,000 state prisoners to be able to vote. And so this is what we're trying. This is what we're doing with that particular committee. And so another thing is that last year we had elections in Philadelphia. And okay. So we had the governor's election. We had the United States Senator election, where we got Josh Shapiro in office and we got John Fetterman in office. And so, but at this time we had Republicans, we even had Democrats, right, that was pushing a fear campaign of incarcerated people and formerly incarcerated people and trying to scare everybody back into a tough on crime stance of mass incarceration, of racial profiling. And we pushed back against that, myself and many other prisoners. So formerly incarcerated people. And so we did political ads pushing back of talking about we want second chances, advocates for second chances. We had a formerly incarcerated banquet where we had politicians from all over come down. We had families and friends come down. We had entertainment. We did it real big there. And then just recently, last Friday, we had the formerly incarcerated people and families rally and weekend power action, where we had people fly in from Chicago, Atlanta, come in from New York, And even as far as California, they all came down here and gave us support. And, you know, we had a big rally. We had entertainers up here. We had my man Joey DeVille straight from North Philly representing Boricua. You know what I'm saying? We had LaShawn, hell of a singer. We had Ken. We had so many people. It's crazy.
I know you put on a show, Shaka Buna. I was gonna ask, like, where can people get this information so that they can take part when these events are going on?
What happens is when I do these events around the city, you know, what I do is I usually try to do it like I try to start advertising it 2 months in advance. And that's how they can get it. They got to get it from social media. I have it
on
Instagram.
So they can go on your IG?
Facebook. Huh?
They can go on your IG? What's that IG, Shaka Buna?
Oh, you know, my IG, Shaka Buna Marshall. You know what I mean?
Okay, y'all heard that.
That's all they got to do is tap in that. They see my face right there. You
know? That's what I'm talking about. Shaka Buna, I do got a question because before we run out of time, you know, this has been on my mind. How is dating now that you're out of prison in comparison to dating someone that is in prison? Like, you know, while you in prison, I know it has to be like a whole different narrative. How's that been for you?
Well, let me tell you this, man. I'm kind of like a anomaly because when I was in prison, I wasn't doing no dating. I gave up on that dating stuff with the women and trying to find a wife and all that because it just wasn't for me. Like, when I first came to prison, you know, I had a woman and everything, and the first 5 years it was good, but I was in love. And the worst thing to be is a person in love, but you're incarcerated because you cannot be with that person you love. So it's very heart-wrenching, right? And I went through a lot of stuff, and it was like a roller coaster ride. I didn't want to do that no more. So I just remained celibate. While I was in prison, I was like an African monk. You know what I mean? And that's just me. You know what I'm saying? I had friends, though. I had, you know, women friends that I talked to, but it was very platonic. You know what I'm saying? And it was about, you know, the movement, about revolution, freedom fighting. And so, but now that I'm home, my whole thing was like, hey, let me date. Let me get to meet people, you know, meet women and everything. And let me try to, get, you know, get something that I didn't have an opportunity to do when I came to prison. So, you know, since then, I dated a couple women and stuff. You know, we had good times and everything. But it's different, you know. It's different because I'm no longer a 17-year-old boy. You know what I'm saying? I'm a grown man. And these women are grown women. They're not children. They're not teenagers. They're not young adults. They full-blown women. And they're experienced. They're professional. They know what they want. But at the same time, I found out that quite a few of them have traumatic experiences in their life, and most of it has dealt with dating or relationships rather. And so as a man coming home from prison, you know, I'm old school, you know, I open up doors, I pull out chairs, you know, I say thank you, you know, I treat a woman like a queen. I treat every woman like a queen. And so, you know, they fall in love with a guy that's doing that and a guy that's intelligent and everything, and they can move, they fall in love with that and they want to be with that. But then what happens is, you know, one small thing can trigger them from past relationships. So coming into relationships today, I have to kind of be like Dr. Phil. I have to, it's kind of like walking in walk on pins and needles, so to speak. You know what I'm saying? Because you don't want to trigger somebody from an experience that they may have with in the past relationship. So what I've learned is that a lot of these guys out here, they done hurt women badly, and now I'm like, I'm dealing with it.
You're dealing with the side effects of these women and these relationships. I do got a question though, right? I was thinking in my head, you know, do you feel like these women are moving kind of fast for you because they out here, they trying to get a man, they trying to get a husband. And you just came home, so you like fresh meat. But at the same time, you still trying to figure out what you want. So you trying to dibble, dabble, and see what flavors are out there of right. different women.
Yeah, and that's right. And I tried to do that, but like you said, they are moving too fast. And then I have to pump the brakes. I'm like, hold up. As I explained before, I just got finished doing 34 years in prison, my sister, and I'm not ready to just go full-blown into a full-blown relationship or into a marriage. And I just met you, and we only known each other 2 months. You know what I'm saying? No, that is not happening. I don't even know you like that. You know what I'm saying? But this is the point. The point is to, you know, get to know each other and see how, whether we're compatible or not, and then see where it goes and not harm one another. You know what I'm saying? So I'm not trying to exploit no woman. I'm not trying to harm no woman. I'm not trying to abuse no woman. I don't beat no woman. I don't mistreat a woman. I don't talk bad to a woman. I try to be very respectful. You know what I'm saying? And I try to treat them like a queen, but, and they love it. But sometimes, man, the past experience of their relationships get in the way of things, and they want what they want, and they want it now. And I understand it, because they haven't been in prison for 34 years like I have. So for them, they've been through all that. They've been through the dating. They've been through all that stuff. And so now they at a point where, like, look, I want a man. I want to settle down. I want a husband. I don't want no boyfriend. I don't want a date. I want a husband. And you look like you can be that guy. And so, but I'm on the opposite end. I'm like, I'm not ready for that. I just came home for 34 years. I'm trying to get to know myself. I don't even hardly, you know myself. I mean, I know myself to a great deal, but I don't know like my favorite color, because guess what? In prison for 34 years, my color was browns. I wore browns goddamn day. When I was in the county jail, we wore blues every single goddamn day. I didn't have a choice of decorating my interior design in my house and knowing my favorite colors. I haven't been out there to experience food, so I don't know my favorite food. I thought I may have did. I thought I may know my favorite color. I don't. I don't know them. I don't know these things.
Shakabuna, in regards to what you're saying, I think that it's also about, like you said, taking your time and making sure that the person that is suited for you is the right person, because they also have to have some type of patience, but I also feel like they need to have that understanding of what your experiences have been like being in prison for 34 years. And then also the side effects that come with that as well, because you're still trying to figure yourself out. So I want to say, first and foremost, you know, Shakabuna Marshall on Instagram. I know, I'm not sure if you were talking to somebody, but you know, like you said, you're trying to take it one day at a time. And the other thing that I want to say is, you know, some women haven't been treated like queens. So when they are being treated like a queen, they want to take advantage and say, hold on, I got a good one. So, you know, I'm not mad at them for trying, but you also, I understand you need your time.
Yeah.
This is like the point of the show, Shakabuna.
Huh?
This is the point of the show where we do a jail call at the end of the show. And I got to definitely have you back, because it was such an interesting conversation that we had, talking about all the work in the community, talking about your love life, talking about your transition back home. But this is the part where we do a jail call, and a jail call, you know, normally is that 15 minutes that you get to talk to your loved ones and kind of like put everything into one conversation. It might be happy tears. It might be trying to spill the tea on what's going on, letting them know, you know, you need help, but just letting them know I love you. I love you. I miss you. What I do want to say is, on jail talk, a jail call is a call of action. So what do you want people in our community or out there listening to do today and take some time out so that they can do a call of action, because Shakabuna said this is what you need to know about?
This is my call of action, right? I think that what we all need to do, man, is we all need to focus right now, focus on getting ourselves together. Mentally, physically, and spiritually. And I'm emphasizing mentally. We need self-care. And the reason I say that is because we have a mental health crisis going on in our communities and throughout America. And so we definitely need to get help. We need to seek counseling, you know. And I don't care if you've been in prison and you served prison for any amount of time, come home and get counseling. You know why? Because prison is psychological warfare, and it's to break men and women minds, right? and to break these spirits. And so to make you feel hopeless and stuff and dependent on them. And so what I tell everybody, right, anybody that come out of prison, you're not coming out of there unscathed. You're coming out of there with some sort of residue, right? No matter how well kept you are, even myself, I'm seen well kept and everything. But guess what? I got problems too. And some problems I never even knew I had. But seeing counseling helped me identify these things and to address it. And so we have people on the outside, right? They're suffering too. They're suffering from capitalism. They're suffering from poverty. They're suffering from racism. They're suffering from generational trauma, right? And they also suffer from bad relationships of men abusing women, abusing each other. Like, we need to stop all that. Stop all the abuse of each other. And let's work on building each other up. But we have to start at home. We can't help nobody else if we don't get ourselves together first. So I'm
talking right about that.
Yeah, clean yourself up, man. Clean up your own backyard before you can go outside and clean and talk about somebody else's backyard. You feel what I'm saying? You got to start. You got to clean your house first and get yourself together. Then and only then you can be a help everybody else. Thank you, y'all.
Sakabuna, I want to say thank you so much for coming on Jail Talk today. It was great talking with you. You dropped so many jewels on these people today, and I hope they're out there listening. And like you said, you know, take that time out to worry about what's going on in your garden.
Yeah.
Before you go to someone else's.
Yeah, that's right. Clean your own house up.
Well, we'll be with Jail Talk again every Friday at 4. Thank you again, Sakabuna.
All right, everybody. It's your boy, Sakabuna. Hey, Mr. Philly. Peace.
You just too important. Nobody do body like you do. I can't lose.